Hi, I'm Steve Chiatakis in for Tess Vigeland, and this is the Marketplace Money Podcast for the week of April 30th, 2010. Want some sound financial advice? Buy and hold. It's all about the long term. But when the markets tanked, even those who knew better sold low. What were they thinking?
When we panic, we literally lose our mind. We disconnect from the logical part of our brain. It is gone.
Well, your retirement may be gone, but you'd be surprised just how much $5 can get you.
I will write something in the sand for you and turn it into a greeting card for $5.
Those stories and more are coming up. But first, this week marks the end of the special new home buyer's tax credit. If you got in, congratulations. Of course, that $8,000 you're getting back is kind of a drop in the bucket when you think about it. Still, it seems the extra help from Uncle Sam did encourage quite a few folks to jump on in, including listener Federico Hari. He moved into his new condo in Miami this week.
The home buyer credit, it actually gave me a time frame, which really helped. 4 months ago when I heard about the tax credit, it's what got me dreaming.
Another listener, Cindy Navarrete of Aliso Viejo, California, made the first deadline, but she's going after a short sale. And who knows when the bank will get around to approving that deal.
I was so excited when I first found this place, and it was such in a great neighborhood. It was fantastic price, and it was just everything was falling together. So I have to now wait to see if this fantastic program that's been offered to Americans is something I'm going to be able to take advantage of.
Now, we know about home buyers looking to take advantage of the credit, but Kathy Dayton of Branchburg, New Jersey, rushed her home to the market, thinking the credit would make her place more attractive.
So we thought, well, now maybe that would give people an incentive to buy our house. It hasn't quite worked out that way, it doesn't seem, but that's kind of what we were hoping.
She's still going to try and sell it, but the tax credit won't be materializing anytime soon. What did the credit mean for the housing market long term? Nick Ritsinas is director of Harvard's Joint Center for Housing Studies. Welcome back to Marketplace Money.
Nice to be with you.
How many people took advantage of this credit?
Hard to say. We're still counting, but well over a million families took advantage of the program. Whether they all needed the program or not remains to be seen.
Well, when you say that, does that mean, you know, some people were going to buy houses anyway?
That's exactly the case. I think it's fair to say that, and again, this is hard to measure, but there were a large number of people who would have bought a house anyway who used the credit. Why not? At the same time, there were a significant number, I'm sure, who would not have purchased at this point in time absent the credit.
What did it do to stabilize the market?
Well, I think it did in large measure stabilize the market. The housing market was very fragile, remained somewhat vulnerable, and what this program did was essentially stimulate demand. It allowed us to clear some of the inventory, particularly of new homes. It's allowed the market to somehow address the problem of foreclosed homes. So it did buy some time and hopefully build a bridge to a more stable housing market.
So what happens now? Does the market tank again, Nick, because this carrot goes away?
I think it'll be an interesting test to see to what extent those who benefited from the credit were going to be the demand that comes from tomorrow anyway. So I think what is more likely to happen is there'll still be a stabilized market. I don't imagine there'll be another significant dip. Prices are already pretty low. But I think it pretty well tells us it's not going to be a robust recovery. To some extent, some of that recovery was taken to stabilize the market over the last several months.
You know, we tell people all the time on this show, an $8,000 tax credit is not enough reason to buy a home. I mean, why do you think it worked so well?
Well, it works so well because it does remind us of that adage that if you throw money at a problem, it is going to influence behavior. And that's what the government did. The government essentially said, we will give you money if you do this, if you buy this home.
Hey, what did we learn about the housing recovery through this credit?
One of the things that I learned from the success of the program in terms of motivating decisions is, you know, people still want to own homes. There's still this interest in sort of buying homes, and the government just fed and fueled that interest. Hopefully our memories won't be so short that we'll forget that it's just as easy to lose money buying a home as it is to make money. I think the other thing that's probably, as one reflects back on the credit, is notwithstanding this extraordinary level of government support, with all of that stimulated demand, it's still been a pretty modest recovery. I think it demonstrates how deep a problem we had and how difficult it is going to be to climb that ladder.
Nick Ritsinas of Harvard's Joint Center for Housing Studies, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
I think it's safe to say some of the best lessons we learn in life come during times of adversity, when the chips are really down. So let's then ask what we've learned from the financial meltdown. Did it change behavior on Wall Street? No comment. So what about everybody else? A new survey out next week from Kiplinger's Personal Finance magazine says people have changed. They're worried about the economy, and they've become more frugal to boot. Janet Bodner is the editor at Kiplinger's. Thanks for being here.
Oh, my pleasure, Steve.
So the big news here seems to be that 84% of Americans are still really worried about finances, right, despite talk of recovery. I mean, what accounts for that, do you think, in your mind?
You know, we always say that pocketbook issues, jobs and things like that are lagging indicators. People are more concerned now about losing their jobs than they were a couple of years ago. So as long as that concern is in the back of their mind, they're going to be worried about their finances. So even though the Wall Street bull market has been going on for a year or so now, you know, people don't quite believe it yet.
Are people worried about losing their job? But on the other side, people are less concerned about credit card debt.
Isn't that interesting? And it's almost a reversal of numbers over the last couple of years. The jobs numbers went up from 15% as a worry factor to 18%, and credit card debt went down from 18 to 13. And I think what you've been seeing is people pulling back on what they're buying, people working to pay off credit card debt. And it seems as if people are having some success with that, which I think is some good news from the survey.
Janet, we've heard often that there's this a sense that Americans have that they're not going to be able to do as well as their parents financially. And here we see that 60% of people say their most important financial goal is to maintain stability. And only a little more than 20% are focused on building assets. I mean, what does that say about American families' expectations for the future?
When we asked people how they felt about this 2 years ago, the numbers were very different. They were very close. The stability goal still outpaced the idea of building assets, but it was much closer. It was really around 40% in both cases. Now you have this huge shift toward, you know, 60% maintaining stability. So what's going on here? It may be part of this new frugality that people have been talking about, that, you know, people are going to be less likely to take on debt. They want to pay off their debt. They're going to be more sober about their finances.
I want to touch a little bit on the frugality before we wrap things up. Your survey shows 74% of families say they're trying to be more frugal, but isn't that the point? I mean, we all want to be more frugal. It's whether we can or whether we actually will keep doing that.
Well, you know, that's kind of interesting. A couple of things. In the Thrive and Financial Kiplinger survey, one of the questions that we tried to get at was the idea of values and family values. And we actually did ask people whether their personal values have been aligned more with their financial values as a result of the economy over the last few years. And the result was very positive. You know, people did say, yes, they were trying to do that. Whether they'll actually change their habits long term is kind of open to question. I mean, I think Americans do tend to be spenders. Yeah. But again, the very fact that they're interested in maintaining stability, the fact that they're interested in paying off credit card debt, that sort of thing really does make a difference. So I think that people are becoming more sober about how they're spending and hopefully about how they're planning for the future. But whether we're going to see any huge sea changes, it's hard to tell just yet.
Well, you can find out more about this Kiplinger's Thrivent survey with a link at our website, marketplace.org, and Janet Bodner, the editor at Kiplinger's, thanks for being with us this week.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Steve.
And now to a family that really hasn't felt the effects of the economic meltdown. In a Los Angeles courtroom, the married couple who own the Dodgers baseball team are playing a game of who gets what in a big, high-profile split. There's a lot of money at stake, and that's given commentator Megan Daum a lot to think about.
The divorce proceedings of Dodger baseball team owners Frank and Jamie McCourt give us all the jaw-dropping entertainment we'd expect of the trials and tribulations of the rich and famous. Frank's lawyers allege, for example, that Jamie lived in one Malibu residence and used the property next door as a laundry room. She has requested just under $1 million a month in temporary support, an amount characterized in the legal filing as wholly consistent with the party's marital lifestyle. This lifestyle reportedly included a personal hairstylist and makeup artist, private jets, and monthly mortgage payments on 7 homes. There's nothing new about high-profile divorces that shock and awe the general public with their particular definitions of the phrase, lifestyle to which I've become accustomed. But when I hear these kinds of details, a few nagging questions come to mind. First of all, is having an entirely separate house to do the wash something to aspire to? Isn't that kind of like having to go to a laundromat? I do hope Jamie at least has a laundry cart with wheels. And what does lifestyle mean anyway? Does it refer to the thread count of our actual sheets or the thread count of those in catalogs we pore over while lounging in a bed made up with the begrimed and burlap-like products we bought at Walmart? Is it a literal state of being or ultimately a state of mind? I do feel a little bit sorry for folks in this predicament, not for all they stand to lose in court, but for something they lost long ago, the pleasure of salivating over what they don't have. Look, this is a pleasure I enjoy daily. The lifestyle to which I've become accustomed isn't lacking the essentials of food or shelter, or even a lot of non-essentials like far too many magazine subscriptions. But much of what I'm accustomed to involves thinking about having more. In fact, what's most satisfying about my lifestyle may be the fantasies that result from its being less than entirely satisfying. I wouldn't refuse a set of 800 thread count Egyptian cotton sheets. But I kind of suspect it's almost as much fun to look at them in catalogs as it is to sleep in them in an utterly quotidian fashion. Desire gives us something to work towards. And if what you're accustomed to precludes that kind of desire, doesn't it also deny you a certain kind of humanity? The lesson here? Go ahead and envy the rich, but in moderation. And be glad you can do your laundry, dirty and otherwise, in the convenience of your one measly home.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Steve Chiatakis in for Tess Viglin. Well, every week we take on some of your money questions, and here in the studio with me today to do just that is Liz Pulliam-Weston of MSN Money, and she's right here in L.A. with us. Hi, Liz.
Hey, Steve.
Thanks for being with us today.
Absolutely.
So we all got an email here at Marketplace saying who's working on the holidays this summer. I'll be doing my patriotic duty right here at Marketplace for Independence Day. But
I salute you.
Yeah.
That's one of the pleasures of being self-employed is when you're the boss, you can say, you know what, I'm taking the day off.
And a lot of people do. I'm curious, though, is taking a vacation, is it back in style even with the high jobless rate?
I'm getting the feeling that it is because you saw with the retail sales numbers, there was a lot of pent-up demand that's starting to come forth. I think people are a little bit more optimistic, so they might be willing to spend a little bit more. And I think there's a feeling out there that all those great bargains that we heard about last year aren't going to be around for much longer, so you better grab it now. And cruises were phenomenal for a while. I got an email message saying that I could take a trip to, you know, across the Atlantic and around the Mediterranean, and it was some ridiculous amount of money, like $999 for 14 days. So those kind of deals were there for a while. I don't know if we're going to see those this summer.
That's a long time on a boat, Liz. Don't you think, to go all the way across the Atlantic to the Mediterranean?
If you're under 70, maybe, yeah, that probably would be.
Well, let's get back on the ground. We've got some questions out there. And first we have Tom on the phone from Philadelphia, PA. Hi, Tom.
Hello, how are you?
I'm doing well. What do you do over there in Philly?
Well, I have a couple of micro businesses, and I certainly enjoy watching the Phillies win the National League title 2 years in a row.
Yeah. You beat the Dodgers. Yeah, we know, Tom. Thanks.
Well, I have a couple businesses that are in another sport. I'm the North American agent for Australia's biggest builder of rowing boats, just like you see in the Olympics. You know, a lot of people refer to it as crew.
Australia. I knew I picked up an accent.
Yeah, it's mostly a, you know, South Jersey accent. Sounds a lot like the Sopranos, I know. But I get by. And then the other line of business that I have is we do boat repairs, fix up old boats and resell them, as well as do straight-on repairs and a lot of different things associated with the rowing business.
So, obviously we can't help you with any rowing advice, Tom. So,
yeah, that's what I was really banking on. But while we're on the line, then why don't I throw something else at you?
Please.
One of the thoughts that I have, that when I think about my own personal finances, you know, a lot of personal finance advice comes down to how people are planning for their retirement. Retirement is just not something I see myself doing just out of choice, not out of force. And I know that there's probably some people would say, well, they felt the same way. And I guess I just feel a little bit of guilt about that when I hear all these people who are planning for retirement. I feel like maybe, you know, I should be thinking about something that's a little less liquid than what I typically do, and things that are a little bit more long-term, tax-deferred, Roth IRAs, things of that sort.
You really think that you're not going to retire? I mean, don't you feel like maybe at some point you're going to get a little tired?
No, I mean, because I like to do things with both my brain and my body. I mean, I know that the body won't always be there, but if the brain starts to go and all that, I'm not really quite sure what I'll retire to anyway. If I want to play more golf right now, I can do that. If I want to travel more, I can do that. I could just try and position myself for those things.
All right. Liz, what do you think? Is this a good idea?
I'm one of those people who doesn't really plan to retire either. I think I'm going to be doing what I'm doing or a portion of it for a while. On the other hand, I know that life doesn't always follow my plans. So, Tom, got to ask, can you promise me you won't get old? Because here's the deal. You know, the typical person retires at 62, and about 40% of those don't retire voluntarily. They get disabled, or someone they love gets disabled and they need to take care of them, or they get laid off and they can't find another job. I mean, I understand in your mid-30s you feel like it can go on forever, but you never know what's going to happen. You never know if you're going to run into a situation where you simply cannot go on.
I appreciate that. I actually survived an airplane crash when I was a teenager and all that.
Oh, well, he's invincible then.
Yeah.
Forget it. He's never going to retire. He's never going to die. My gosh.
So, I mean, I'm aware of those things. I do have a health savings account. I am insured. I do have, you know, investments in various different areas. I do have commercial real estate, and I also have equity stocks and such. It's just, you know, looking at things, doing some things in a more short-term way where you can liquidate assets so that you can use them to invest in new business opportunities.
Well, it sounds like you like choice, and that's a good thing. Diversification is great. What you are worried about is tying your money up in a way that will penalize you if you want to get your hands on it.
Mm-hmm.
So what I would say is I wouldn't worry about that with a Roth or an IRA. I mean, that's only, what, $5,000 a year. That's not a lot of money. You can put that aside and pledge to keep your hands off it. I think you can manage that. So put some money in different pots. I mean, keep some of it as, you know, liquid and available to do your ventures, but also take advantage of the tax laws that we've got to help you save for retirement.
What do you think, Tom?
Well, I do think, as you're saying, that $5,000 a year is not a lot, and it's not a bad idea to back up, you know, have that as a backup to various different things. That's definitely doable. Basically, I think I've done a pretty good job of kind of positioning myself for the life that I imagine myself having and all that. I there's not much that I see retiring to. It sounds terribly boring, doesn't it?
Doesn't sound boring at all, actually.
Well, for some people, they just can't imagine it. And other people, that's what they're totally focused on. And
yeah, I mean, for me, it's just like I know I spend a lot of hours working, but it doesn't really feel like work much of the time.
Well, and Tom, you sound like one of the people that's doing the lifestyle design thing, where you're having a bit of retirement now and you're having the full life, which my hat's off to you. I'm just saying, down the road, if you get disabled, get sick, decide that you don't want to do whatever you're doing, you want to have a choice. So just cover your bases now so you have a choice later.
Well, I appreciate that. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Tom, for the call. We do appreciate it. We're always here to answer your questions, no matter where you're from. Our voicemail is here for you anyway. The number is toll-free, 1-877-275-6669. That's 877, and it spells out Ask Money. We spell it M-O-N-Y. Or you can send us an email at marketplace.org, and you'll see the Getting Personal link on the left-hand side. And we have another caller on the line right now. Another one actually out east, Liz. This is Anna, who's with us from Vineland, New Jersey. Hi, Anna.
Hi, Steve. How are you?
Doing well. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about what's going on in New Jersey.
Well, I just got accepted into graduate school.
Wow.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much. It's really exciting. Now I'm looking at how to best pay for it.
What are you studying, Anna?
I'll be going for public policy.
Public policy. So what does that entail? Public policy, are we talking about politics maybe down the road? Or
not so much politics. The program I'm going for, I'm going to the University of Chicago. It's more quantitative focused, looking at data, looking at policy repercussions, cost benefit, things like that.
Incentivizing certain behaviors or what?
Yeah.
Okay.
Kind of what behavior it induces.
That's fantastic. That's great.
Thank you.
So, all right. So the question on the table then is how's she going to pay for this?
Okay.
Right.
So your options are student loans, and what else were you looking at?
Well, I'm looking at my Roth contributions to my IRA.
Ah. You know, Liz, she's talking about breaking into her retirement.
Yeah.
You know what that means.
Yeah.
Your retirement is sacred. Forever and ever. Amen.
Amen. And don't you forget it, Anna.
I don't forget it. I know it. I work in financial services. It's been pounded into us. You know, retirement is important. But I'm looking at the unsubsidized Stafford loans. And the interest rate right now is 6.5%.
Mm-hmm.
Starts accruing immediately. You know, it doesn't wait till I get out of school like the subsidized do. With the unsubsidized loan, I'm guaranteed to pay 6.5% immediately.
Mm-hmm.
The average return on my IRA, let's say 8%, 8.5%,
mm-hmm.
could be better, could be worse.
Yeah.
Is it worth taking on the risk of the stock market for 1.5% or 2%?
Well, and you've picked the one type of retirement account where this discussion could even be had. Because as you probably know, if you were taking this money out of a 401k or an IRA, you'd be facing a big tax hit, at least 25%. With a Roth, you can always take your contributions out. And how much money is sitting there now?
I'd be looking to take out maybe $6,000 in contributions.
Oh, okay. And how much is the education going to cost you?
Oh, much, much more than that.
Not $6,000, Liz.
But the idea is to delay taking those unsubsidized loans for as long as possible,
mm-hmm.
to put off the interest accruing.
Okay. I wouldn't be too afraid of federal loans. I mean, federal student loans are about the best debt that you can have. They are relatively low rate. They're fixed rate. The interest is going to be tax deductible. What I'm worried about actually more is the job that you're shooting for, is the pay the first year going to pay off, going to be equal to or less than the debt you're taking on? Do you know?
It will probably be equal to or less than.
Okay. All right.
I would say pretty close, one way or the other.
Okay. Because that's kind of a bright line for me. If you're taking on more debt in total than you expect to make your first year out of school, you are consigning yourself to a heck of a lot of debt. It's like taking on another mortgage. And after I've said all these wonderful things about how great this debt is, the reality is it's really, you know, I mean, the student loan collectors will chase you down until you're dead if you don't pay. There's hardly any way to get out from under this burden. So you want to be smart about how much debt you're taking on. You know, I would be really reluctant to take money out of a Roth simply because it is tax-free in retirement. We don't know what the tax situation is going to be like. And you know that every $1,000 you take out now is going to cost you $20,000 or more in lost retirement income. To save yourself from $6,000 of debt, to give up all that future tax-free income, I'd have a hard time doing it. How do you feel about it? I mean, what's at the center of this?
How do I feel about it?
Yeah.
Well, because of what you just said about debt collectors being able to chase me down into debt,
okay, all right.
I like the idea of being that much less in debt.
Yeah. I don't think you need to worry about, you know, being chased by debt collectors. You know, you're not going to be one of those people who takes on $200,000 of debt and doesn't get the degree. So personally, I would leave that Roth money alone and just let it grow for you.
So the bottom line is don't touch the retirement. Hey, Jeff, can we play that one more time?
Your retirement is sacred forever and ever.
Amen.
Amen.
Okay.
Pass the tray.
I'm reconvinced.
All right. Thanks for the call, Anna.
Thanks.
Bye-bye. So, Liz, you ready for another phone call?
I am indeed.
All right. We're back on the West Coast now.
Yay.
So we have Lori, who's on the phone. She's just up the highway from us in Van Nuys, California, as we know it as the San Fernando Valley. Hi, Lori.
Hello.
How are you today?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Good. Thanks for the call.
Oh, my pleasure.
Now, you're here in Los Angeles. What do you do over here?
I am an accounting manager for a law firm.
And you've been doing that for a long time?
Oh, so many years.
She says she like thinks about her career.
I sense she's closer to retirement than Tom may be.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So what brings you to Marketplace Money?
Well, my question actually does concern retirement. My sister and I are considering combining our households, oh, probably 10, 12 years in the future. I am planning on retiring. She is planning on going out feet first from her job.
One of us. Okay. Gotcha.
My question is, I own a home. I will own it outright by the time I retire. Should I rent the house out when I move into my sister's house, or should I sell it?
And I keep thinking, you know, you're going to move in with your sister? That's going to be, wow.
Oh, you have no idea how well that's going to be.
Is it really?
Oh, yeah. No, we get along really, really well.
That's wonderful, actually, to have that kind of support and have someone to move in with.
Well, exactly. We will take care of each other.
What, right. And just the two of you? Maybe some pets?
Currently, 12 cats between the two of us.
Oh, no.
Well, I think you may have to do something about that.
There will be attrition with the cats. There will definitely be attrition.
That's going to be quite a litter box, I'll tell you that much. My goodness. Oh, my gosh. All right, so Lori and her sister and the 12 cats. Liz?
Well, she'd almost certainly be positive cash flow on this property because that means that you would obviously get more in rent than you're paying out because it'll be paid off. What you have to consider is, do you want to be a landlord? The other thing is you have to count on vacancies. And some of the landlords I talk to figure for every, you know, they figure a vacancy rate of about 25%.
Mm.
That just means when you have a single family property that for every year you might have it empty for 3 months. Now, you could get lucky, get great tenants, keep them forever. And it's something that you can start, try it.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't like it, you can always sell the house.
What's your house like, Lori?
It's 2-bedroom, 1-bath. I've redone everything there is to redo in the house, the kitchen, the bathroom. Last year I redid the backyard completely. So it's beautiful with native plants and a pergola in the back to sit under. It is. It's very nice.
Sounds like a little jewel. Okay. I would really recommend a sit down with the fee-only financial planner. This is a really good time. You're 10 years out from retirement to go over your whole plan and talk about some of these things. Because on the surface, it sounds like renting out the house could be a nice way to supplement your income. A lot of people in your situation don't have enough saved for retirement. So they really do need to sell the house to add to their investments, you know, kind of beef up what they've got. But it sounds like you could go either way. It's more a matter of, you know, your own personal inclination.
Yeah, so, would it be hard for you, Lori, to see renters in your house, the one that you love so much and that, you know, have taken good care of?
If I found someone who loved it as much as I do and would take care of it, no, I wouldn't have a problem with it. Because I live so close to my sister, we're really only a mile apart, I can pop over to the house at any time and take a look at what's going on.
May I interject a personal story here?
Absolutely.
Because I have been a landlord.
Yes.
Having moved here from Alabama, from the South, which is at least 2,000 miles away, and I can tell you, it's not fun. 2,000, especially being very far away. Now, I don't know about a mile away or you know, in the same neighborhood, things like that, but I can tell you from far away, having tenants in a house, it's something I would dissuade you from.
Yeah, the fact that she is so close is going to help her keep an eye on the property. But again, you should go talk to some of the friends you have, if you have any that have rental property, about their situations. There are landlord associations in the Valley. Join it. Talk to those folks, because I get the horror stories all the time. Definitely want to do credit checks on these people. You want to do background checks.
Mm-hmm.
You want to be picky about your tenants, because this is, you know, your investment, your property.
Right.
And you want to be by the pool, Lori, don't you? I mean, you don't want to be taking calls from tenants, you know, when you're retired.
Right.
Yeah. The other argument I could see for selling the house is if you need to get on equal footing financially with your sister. I mean, you're moving into her house, so.
Well, certainly it would be split right down the middle.
I'd split it among the cats, actually.
You know, if I could get them jobs, I certainly would.
12 cats among the two of them. My goodness. Does that do it for you, Lori?
It certainly does, and I appreciate it very much.
Good luck to you.
Thank you so much.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, so we're going to, I guess, retire Liz from taking calls now, just for now. You can reach us at any time, though. Give us a call on our money line. That's 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY, M-O-N-Y. And, of course, you can write us an email with your question as well. Look for the Getting Personal link on the homepage, marketplace.org. Liz Weston from MSN Money and author of Your Credit Score. Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
We appreciate it. And remember to consult with your own financial professional before making any big money decisions. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Steve Chiatakis, in for Tess Figlin. It's become known as Woodstock for capitalists, the annual shareholder meeting of Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway. Shareholders big and small are in Omaha, Nebraska this weekend. A whole slew of events is planned. There's, of course, the meeting itself, a special shopping spree, picnics, cocktail parties. It's become quite the bash. Certainly one way to drum up shareholder interest. More fun than figuring out what to do with those shareholder voting statements delivered to our doors from time to time. If your biggest concern with those is how to throw them away, well, you're not alone. But a website called MoxieVote is hoping to change all that. Doug Gates is one of the company's founders. Doug, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks, Steve.
So what is MoxieVote and how does it work?
It's a proxy voting platform. If you're a shareholder in a public company, you get this thick packet of information once a year from that company encouraging you to vote on important business issues that they've got. 90% of people throw those away, and we're trying to stop that. It's intimidating. It's filled with legal language. You're not given enough information to know what you're voting on. You don't know why you're voting on it. You don't know exactly what you're voting on. Most people own so few shares that it's just a rational decision to just not vote.
If I'm, Doug, a small shareholder of this company, how can I possibly make a difference? I mean, if I own like, you know, 40 shares, 100 shares, even like 500 shares, can I really make a difference?
Well, I guess you could ask the same question about presidential elections. Can one person make a difference? No, probably not. But if you band together and vote your shares with blocks of people, you can definitely make a difference. Just last year, there was a proxy battle where the chairman and CEO of Bank of America, he lost his title of chairman by a 0.3% margin. And Ken Lewis is now just the CEO of B of A. So yeah, it can make a difference.
And you guys there was something else going on with Google, right?
Yeah, that happened in December. Google had offered a merge with a video technology provider called Onto Technologies. And some of the Onto shareholders were upset and thought that they could command a higher price from Google. And so they banded together and about 10% of them voted through the MoxieVote website and kind of put the brakes on the merger. And Google came back and offered them, I think, $25 million. And they said, OK, we'll take that.
And that was a direct response to what happened on MoxieVote?
We think so. It's hard to draw exact lines of cause and effect, but we certainly gave a platform to the shareholders that didn't exist before.
You talk about platforms. On your website, you have this link to an advocates page. Does that mean you can put your proxy vote with certain groups, advocacy organizations?
Yeah. Organizations that have opinions on the way that your proxy should be voted and the ways the company should be run and the kind of the way that society itself as we know it exists. So we're talking about people like the Teamsters or the Humane Society, organizations who want to sway your opinion to vote with them, where you can band together and vote your shares with people who have informed opinions, access to members, and the desire for a big megaphone where they can reach out and actually convince people to vote alongside of them.
What's in it for you? I mean, as far as being a successful business, how do you make money with MoxieVote?
Right now, we don't. Right now, we are trying to prove the idea and prove that dogs will actually eat the dog food that we've spent the last year building. So the goal, kind of like Twitter, took a few years to catch on, and they just recently unveiled their revenue plan. We have chosen to forestall revenues for the time being, or forego revenues for the time being, to focus on building the right dog food.
Will it change, do you think, the way corporations conduct business with shareholders down the road?
We hope so. There's no passion in proxy voting right now, and people aren't voting their proxies, or the individual shareholders aren't voting their proxies, because it's just a boring process. And if we can put some passion into it and get people to vote their shares alongside the people that they care about and the issues that they care about, I think the companies will start to take note and will start to try to feed off of that passion and try to divert some of that passion for the management proposals.
All right, Doug Gates, we appreciate it. One of the founders of MoxieVote. Thanks a lot, Doug.
Thank you.
Whether you're a student heading off to college in the fall or the parent who very well may foot the bill, the privilege of higher education comes with a hefty price tag. This week, the College Board said graduates can carry an enormous amount of debt. A quarter of graduates from private colleges leave with more than $30,000 in debt, and more than half of those going to for-profit schools borrow even more. Patricia Steele is with the College Board. Patricia, how did you come to your findings?
Well, we decided to look at, you know, the prevalence of high debt across these various groups. So, you know, what we found is independent students, your non-traditional older students, are much more likely to be to have high debt situations when they graduate. We also looked at race. The sample sizes are quite small when you're looking at race, but we did see generally that African-American students tended to be in that high debt category more often than other race groups. The interesting finding, though, was by income, there was not as much variation as we expected. Students at all levels of incomes had an equal likelihood of being in that high debt category. And some of that is attributable to the types of choice of institutions that students make. But we didn't see a significant difference on that end.
You're one of the authors of this analysis, and the conclusion here is too many students are borrowing more than they're likely to be able to manage down the road. I mean, that's a pretty startling conclusion.
Yeah, that's right. We looked at this data once before, and we noticed that there is this growing minority of students who are just borrowing astronomical amounts of money, you know, higher than $45,000. So we decided to take that top quartile of borrowers. What stands out is that these students are much more likely to take out non-federal loans, which often are the loans with, you know, far less favorable terms on them. And these students are borrowing in very high amounts.
It looks as if there's a really big difference in the debt students carry between for-profit and not-for-profit schools.
Right. That's one of the interesting findings, is you can see that the prevalence of high debt borrowing is much more significant in the for-profit sector, 53% compared to 24% in the private four-year sector and 12% in the public four-year sector. So a very big difference.
And why is that?
Well, the for-profit sector, you know, similar to the private four-year sector, of course, has higher prices. But the difference is that for-profit institutions generally don't have the generous institutional grant and scholarship programs that you see in the nonprofit sectors.
So they're borrowing more money.
That's right. They have to borrow to meet the cost.
We heard from a caller earlier who was thinking about paying for part of her grad school by taking money from her Roth IRA. Our money analyst Liz Pulliam-Weston cautioned her about taking on too much debt, even federally subsidized debt at reasonable rates, because even if you have a good education, starting out with a lot of debt is not a good idea. So what do you do?
This is an important point. I obviously would never recommend to someone to not take on any debt. I think taking on some debt is okay, taking it on carefully, understanding the terms of the loans that you're about to enter into is very important. And honestly, without student loans, there's many students for whom college would not even be an option. But you're right. I mean, in this economy, students are facing a difficult job market and a tremendous debt load. And to me personally, I'm often very concerned for students who can no longer make the choice to work in public service, you know, to work in schools, to work as a social worker, because they have a huge loan debt. But I will point out that many students do graduate without debt. So it's not that the problem is for all students. It's that there's this minority of students for whom, you know, debt loads are getting increasingly high. And it's important for the policy conversations to focus on that.
Patricia Steele, research consultant to the College Board, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
The financial meltdown hit millions of people where it hurts the most, their retirement. All kinds of investments lost value, but what some people did might have actually contributed to their losses. Despite advice to the contrary, there were folks who were so afraid of losing even more money, they sold all their shares in stock, even though prices were way low. And that prompts us to say,
let me start with question number one. What the hell were you thinking?
In this installment of our series on why people do what they do with their money, reporter Sally Herships tells this cautionary tale of human instinct and investment.
Allison Lenthal lives in Maryland. She's in public relations. Before the recession, she'd invested her 401k in aggressive growth stocks. She was only 35, so she figured she had plenty of time to let it grow.
So Dad had taught me to buy and hold. And I can remember being in an economics class in high school where we were given, you know, funny money to put into the market and see who could, you know, accrue the most. And it was always just buy and hold, buy and hold. I can hear it in my sleep.
But then Allison started learning everything she could about the market, reading business magazines, even watching Jim Cramer. Then, on September 15th, 2008, Lehman collapsed. A couple weeks later, the market dropped by 777 points in one day. A month after that, the market was down another 1,800, and Allison's portfolio had lost 50%, $10,000. But even though she knew not to sell low, she did. Are these emotional actions or logical actions?
Oh, these are clearly emotional actions. They almost occur like you don't have a choice. Like they just become instinctual. You just do them.
Allison says if she could go back in time, she'd do things differently. But she panicked. So why do people make decisions that are clearly not in their own best interests?
When we panic, we literally lose our mind. We disconnect from the logical part of our brain. It is gone.
Rick Kaler is a certified financial planner in South Dakota. He writes books on the psychology of money.
You cannot be logical when you have been triggered, when you're flooded with emotion. And I think everybody can relate to this in perhaps an argument you've had with a significant other. And you say things and you do things that you later regret.
When we lose it, the limbic system, the part of our brain that handles emotion, literally drowns out the cortex, the part of our brain that handles logic. But Kaler says there is a good side to this. Say you're crossing the street and a semi comes out of nowhere at 90 miles an hour. You don't want to just stand there analyzing the situation.
This is why the limbic system shuts off the thinking part and says, listen, just move.
We can react to a fall in the market in the same way we react to a speeding truck, by panicking. Jonah Berger is a professor of marketing at Wharton, and he says when these animal instincts kick in, we also start acting like sheep.
If you look at herds that get scared, right, one thing gets scared and starts to move in a particular direction, and the rest of the herd goes and follows that thing.
Because they think the first sheep to run away has some piece of information that they don't. But the herd instinct is good in a lot of ways.
It saves packs of antelopes from lions, and it saves people from situations that might not be good for them. But in other cases, it leads them to, you know, zig when they should zag because the first person who went ahead didn't know any better than the rest of the people.
So it's not always safe to follow the pack. Berger also says a lot of the information we share can be very selective. We tend to pass along only the most extreme, more interesting stories.
And there's that old news adage, right? If it bleeds, it leads.
Because of that, it's the extreme stories that tend to get around more. And that, Berger says, can lead to outcomes that are unrealistic, like the overinflated housing market.
Part of the reason we had a bubble in the first place is because everyone was sharing stories about the friend they happen to know who, you know, in a year doubled the price of their home and made a huge profit and sold and got out.
So to make sure I'm not guilty of passing along extreme stories, I wanted to find out how many people really did panic when the recession hit. I asked Brian Reed. He's chief economist at the Investment Company Institute.
Most investors really sat tight during the stock market decline.
So they did nothing.
They did nothing.
Reed says most Americans who own stock own it through mutual funds. And in the fall of 08, during that very dramatic market drop, about 13% of investors closed at least one fund. Normally, that number would be closer to 4%. But keep this in mind.
We don't know where they took the money. Did they turn around after they sold one stock fund and invest in another stock fund?
He says we don't know. It's almost impossible to track. Back in Maryland, Allison Lenthal is one of the sellers who hasn't reinvested yet. Do you regret your decision now to sell?
Yes, I do regret my decision. I do. So now I am going to reinvest my money into, you know, smart choices, mutual funds, and I'm going to buy and hold.
You're going to follow the rule, buy and hold. This time.
I'm going to get a tattoo. It's going to say buy and hold.
Lenthal considers this a learning experience. If she'd held onto her funds instead of selling, she'd have $6,500 to show for it. It's an expensive lesson, but at least it's one she'll always remember. I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace Money.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. And finally, got $5 burning a hole in your pocket? There's this website we recently stumbled across. It's called Fiverr.com. Fiverr spelled F-I-V-E-R-R. And it calls itself the place for people to share things they're willing to do for $5, such as,
I will write something in the sand for you and turn it into a greeting card for $5. I will help you research and write your college or high school paper for $5.
That's Mike Kaufman. He spoke to us from Tel Aviv, Israel, where he developed Fiverr.com. There's a bunch of categories. Writing, I will translate a paragraph from Japanese. Technology, I will provide technical support for any cell phone. Or even the fun and bizarre, I will pretend to be married to you on Facebook. Wow. Kaufman says so far the site has about 40,000 listings.
If someone thinks that the service is worth it, they order it, and if they don't, they don't. It makes things very, very simple.
Users can rate providers so there's some quality control, and the site is monitored for abuse. You can also use the website to order something you think is worth $5. Kaufman did it, a custom-written song.
I ordered it for my wife as a present, and the only thing that I gave was my wife's name.
And so, in what we think must be the premiere on public radio,
Iris, baby, you can call me crazy, but there's nobody else in the world I'd rather love.
Of course, all this $5 business got us thinking. What service would our colleagues here at Marketplace be willing to do for a Lincoln spot? Engineer Jeff Peters, hey.
I'd take out your trash.
Oh, from the entire Marketplace trash department?
No, your trash at your house.
Oh, that trash. All right. Assistant producer Millie Jefferson?
I would attend a meeting for you that you didn't want to go to.
Oh, I've got like $20 for you here. Eve Tro, assistant producer of Marketplace Money?
Well, I'm really good at talking to people's parents. I will call your mom and talk to her, and I will tell her you're getting plenty of sleep and you're eating right, and whatever you need me to tell your mom, I will tell her.
Interested in any of those? Maybe you have some ideas of your own. Drop us a line here at marketplace.org.
Nobody else.
And that's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, after a century of life, no one expects you to remember everything.
How old are you?
I don't know. I don't count anymore. Judy, you know how old I am?
You're 102.
Oh, that's interesting.
Memory or not, living to 100 is expensive. Dollars and cents for centenarians. And a big welcome to a new member of the Marketplace Money family this week. We all love the sunshine of Phoenix, Arizona. You'll be able to hear us there on Phoenix Public Radio, KJZZ 91.5 FM. Marketplace Money is produced by Deborah Clark with Stephen Hoffman and Eve Tro. Our technical director is Josh Rogerson. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yor. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Tess Vigeland is back next week. Take care.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org, or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again. Marketplace Money is supported by Putnam Investments, offering strategies for investors seeking both returns and lower volatility. On the web at putnam.com/absolute return.
American Public Media.